that you would then introduce a additional capacitance to neutralize the additional inductance, and how would that affect the radiation resistance? So that's a good question. Electrical engineers out there, you got a good answer?
Yeah, and by the way, I kind of see it as a as the amount of surface area exposed to free space. So the longer antenna has got more, creating a larger boundary to the space. So I think that's probably what's determining radiation resistance. But again, that's, I'm just free-winging it here out of the gift. So every double E's out there that might have the answer, that would be a good thing.
Yeah, maybe we can cajole someone who knows a lot more than I do to get into this. You also have to kind of factor in that you can't have even a radiation resistance isn't probably a very simple thing either, because as you increase the length of the antenna, you can't really increase the radiation resistance, because that increases the total feed point impedance and ruins the efficiency of the transfer of energy going into the antenna. So I guess you could use a ballon to act as a transformer. So it gets even more complicated, because now not only do you have a corrective capacitance in an overlong antenna, but you have you may or may not have the need for a impedance transforming ballon at the feed point. So it gets worse and worse the more I think about it.
NY2H. Well, this is what I'm thinking. So you correct your impedance issues. And, you make your full thing just resistive. But, if you have a short antenna, you're correcting, like you say, you're adding inductance. You have a longer antenna, you're adding capacitance. Fine. So we re-achieve resonance at this longer antenna, but the full antenna, which is bounded to free space, is still that same length. I'm sure we're using the full length of the antenna, even though it's greater than a half wave, because we've tuned out, the resonance, reactance, rather. So again, given the two choices, back to the original question, you have a shorter antenna, which you've adjusted now into resonance, or antenna which you've adjusted into resonance. I think the radiation resistance may be greater on the longer antenna, and so I'll choose that one. I think the question was which would be better. Does it make a big difference? I doubt it.
Okay, it might be. I really have to thumb through some source to figure out what happens to the radiation resistance. You have other things happening when you change from a perfectly resonant antenna. Your radiation pattern gets rather funky. You get these weird nodes and null points, which might help you in some circumstances and harm you in other circumstances. So again, it's complicated, confusing, and the reality of most of our lives is we seldom have an opportunity to make our antennas longer. It's kind of how short can we get away with type of thing. So in the real world, especially in the metropolitan area, it's seldom a case of shall I build it long or shall I build it short. It's how short can I get away with. But, your mileage might vary.
And I guess if you make it longer, you're going to end up with a traveling wave antenna. You're going to be off the end of it.
It's better to have it longer than it is shorter at, like 14.2. Again, if you had to choose, I think, as Lou was saying, I think you want an antenna that's longer and use a tuner on that than using a tuner on an antenna that's shorter at the resonant frequency.
Well, ultimately I would tend to agree with you, especially if you if you adjust it either with something on the antenna or through the transmission line and effectively retune it. You have other problems with losses and reflections and all kinds of fun stuff. But, I mean, ultimately that's sort of what we do in many ways. We kind of put up antennas that are either the proper size or smaller and try and get away with it. And then we have better success with shorter, higher frequencies, multiples that are harmonics that resonate for that frequency longer than it needs to be. Again, at the price of creating these random nodes, depending upon which design you use, you don't get a nice clean donut like you see images of a center-fed dipole. It starts to develop all kinds of freakish nodes and nulls. But in practice, we kind of do that for the harmonics of the primary frequency that we cut an antenna for. But we keep on trying to make those antennas be a little shorter just to fit in the spaces that we use. Any more comments on this? There must be some more comments.
What about those antennas that are totally non-resident, over?
Well, but now you're talking about the traveling wave antennas, which are an interesting topic, but have nothing really to do with it. They're not inductive, they're not capacitive. They're just a long length of wire with a terminating load. And, you know, whatever gets out of the antenna before it gets burnt up in the terminating load is your output. You know, some traveling wave antennas are decent. They're not terribly efficient. As far as I'm aware, we talked about the folded dipole, loaded dipole. It's folded over with a loading resistor at the center connecting it. But, yeah, you could use a traveling wave, but they work differently, and the point of the exercise changes a little bit. The benefit is it works on any frequency, sort of, but not terribly well. But sometimes not terribly well is all you need.
K2GJE, yet the people out at RCA Radio Central use only Robix, big Robix, fed with open wire line, over.
Okay. Again, there are some manifestations that work reasonably well. I still don't think traveling wave antennas are 100% efficient, but you might be able to build some with enough wire on them. You know, beverage antennas are excellent for receiving. You build them nice and long. Not so much for transmitters, but I agree with you that there are some traveling wave antennas that are decent for transmitters. But I still think that if you kind of add up all the efficiencies, standing wave antennas probably are theoretically a lot more efficient. That might be important for some and not important for others, depending upon what you need.
I think it's all in the length. The best antenna I ever had was three half waves in length, fed one quarter wave off one end, and it was on 20 meters. And when I lived in Europe, I spoke to people on the East Coast every night religiously. Over.
C2GS. Well, yeah, especially for traveling wave antennas, the longer you build them, the better they are, because once they get to that loading resistor, it's game over. Again, even for a standing wave, it does introduce novel nulls and nodes, but they can be beneficial. It depends upon how you locate it, where it is you like to talk to. So all those strange little bumps that longer than half-wave antennas tend to produce might be very, very useful. know, it depends on the individual and their luck, I guess.
Can I backtrack a second on reactants?
Sure.
I think the whole difference with reactants as opposed first to resistance, with resistance, the current and the voltage is in phase. With reactants, whether it be capacitive reactants or inductive reactants, they're out of phase in a resonant circuit, which isn't perfect at any time, where current and voltage is exactly in phase. It is like a load that absorbs all the power. When the load is either reactive or inductive, the current and the voltage are out of phase, and the way power is measured in those circuits is E times I times the cosine of the angle between two, and that gives you a lesser number if E and I were both in phase, over.
Yes, Ed recognized. I just want to mention that's sort of what power factor is. And another thing that I want people hopefully to keep in mind is that resistance is independent of frequency, whereas reactances are frequency dependent. Ed, please.
This is But yeah, well, back in the day, there used to be fellow on this computer was a local power station, and I used to count out the power kilowatts, and just went for the kilowatts, bars, volts, and stuff that has the letter K in front of it, and I used that terminology.
Yeah, I mean, the power correction, power factor correction is a big thing in businesses. Thankfully, not something that the utilities kind of push on consumers, but you sort of see it every so often as a scam. You'll see these ads on, God forbid, Facebook and such for energy-saving devices that basically amount to a crappy little capacitor. The idea is that your refrigerator is producing inductance that's screwing up your power supply, I guess, and this piddly little capacitor that you plug in from the box is going to save you, you know, 10 cents or something every year. I don't know. So, you know, power factor is important for industry. You know, and that's a basis of reactance.
Wait a minute.
Yes,
the power company, the problem is they bill you for reactive power, and adding a capacitor resonates with the inductance. Power company
money, not the consumer. Yeah, but it doesn't save them that much because it's a piddly little capacitor. So yeah, it's just one of the many grips that I see passing by on different medium.
Power companies do pass to the bank on power poles for that very reason.
Yeah, but you don't need to supply your own for out of Facebook ads.
No, but the power company appreciates you taking one to the team.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone writes them a letter and tells them that they're thinking of them and they bought one of those power savers on Facebook. And I wonder what their public relations response for something like that might be.
I realize the cost of the stamp was swamped to save it.
Well, I think we've kind of beaten this around a lot. Anyone with any other comments to make on this particular subject? Not that I have another subject, but just in case we do. Okay, I take that as a definitive no. Jim, as always, relied on you. Did you come up with an interesting question since last we chatted?
Oh, wow. I'm called upon to act, and I'm a little short. I will say that be interesting conversation about the reactants and other characteristics of an antenna. And the rowing analogy, more and more I think there's an application there. It's very interesting that when you if you row a boat, not paddle or power or steam drive, but if you row a boat, there's so many interesting things that happen that have to do with the frequency of the pulse that you apply to the propulsion of the craft, the intensity of the pulses. I can't help but think that there's some analogies here that could be useful to help people learn what the formulas say. It's so hard to comprehend. Over to Roy.
Yeah, I think what's going on with rowing is that there is a certain physiological rhythm that's most efficient for the human form to get the most energy into propulsion. So there probably is something that's pseudo-resident about someone paddling or rowing. Yeah, I unfortunately don't discern much difference. But, you know, rowing, I think, is dependent upon the life form doing the rowing, what's the most efficient. So there is a degree of anatomical resonance that has to be kept in mind for efficient rowing. How you kind of work that into leading voltages or lagging voltages, I wouldn't have a clue. But I could certainly see that that would be a demonstration of some degree of resonance. Always, Ed. You're always welcome.
All problems do not have the ball on it. Usually a piece of ball on it, you let go of that and it can't fall in the water. But what you're supposed to do is as you return the ball back to the starting point, you're supposed to turn rotate the ball so the blade parallel to the water doesn't catch your head in air. Another thought I have is, you're talking about various multi-rower vessels, like old galleys or thousands of years ago, or a crew boat, worked it out to absolute perfection.
Okay, again, seems to be noise on the repeater. Anyway, I think you might have some kind of pseudo resonance. And Ed, if you're talking about a rowing nightmare, I think it was the Greeks had these things called trimarans, which were three level rowing boats. You know, you had slaves probably at the bottom of the boat, slaves at the medium, and slaves on the higher end. So it was a three-decker rowing ship. Can you imagine getting all those guys in time?
I had a guy with a drum.
I think the guy that was out of rhythm didn't fare so well, and so the other one fared better. That was part of the game.
I would assume.
Everybody would think about it.
Yeah, that's probably the method they used. You know, drums go back into prehistory, and it's the best way to punctuate activity. So you're probably correct that they had a drummer. You couldn't really play a horn that way, so they probably had a big loud drum beating it endlessly in time with the thrusting. But trimarans, those were amazing ships. I remember chatting with good old John, KC2WGB, about trimarans, three-deckers. Those were amazing ships. I don't think there's been one since the Roman times.
PhD, seeing if I got it.
Yep, Jim.
I think there's an analogy that I think can be helpful to us all to reach across the void from the formulas to the copper antenna hanging over our house. In the rowing thing. I've never got a chance to row a really good rowing craft. A low resistance rowing craft. But I've rowed high reactance oars, and you know, the size of the paddle and the speed of the stroke, and all it's all these parallels that they're not the same. I make no sailors are the same, but they help us understand what we're talking about. Some of us can throw out the formulas, but to innately understand what we're talking about is difficult for me. I know. Again, I'm operating above my pay grade. Just some thoughts to share. Over to Roy.
Yeah, sure. I understand entirely, Jim. Analogies are very, very, very useful. But you got to keep in mind that they are analogies, and that ultimately that means that they fail because they're not one-to-one perfect representations of what you're trying to get across. But, you know, and some analogies are far better than others. One analogy that used to and still drives me insane is the Bohr atom that has been mentioned on the technical net for at least probably 20 years. And that's a simplified representation that gives people the wrong impression that an atom is like a solar system, where the nucleus is the sun and the planets are the electrons, and they rotate around the nucleus and they spin on themselves, which is a Newtonian kinetic physics concept that quantum mechanics has nothing to do with. And, you know, electrons are not spinning spheres. They're point charges, and what rotates is not the electrons, but some aspect of the polarization of electrons, and on and on and on. The bottom line is, I appreciate a good analogy. I use them often. I find analogies, though, sometimes to be two-edged swords. They could help you, but they could cut you. It depends on what kind of analogy you select and how intensely someone takes that as being the reality of the situation instead of just a useful analogy to help people along the way.
A thought on that?
Always.
I like to view analogies as steps on rungs on a ladder to help you get to the next step. Sometimes the people that are higher up on the ladder don't appreciate the gravity of those steps to those of us down a few rungs below them. And I think I can't think of a better tool for us mere humans to use to get to the next step on the ladder, recognizing that we're on a step that's below other people in our understanding of a thing. That's just my thought. I could be completely wrong.
Oh, Jim, that is a fine analogy. The only thing I would add to it is it's perfectly fine to be a step on the ladder, but I feel bad for people who decide that it's a chair to sit on, and that's as far as they go. So if it's a means to an end, that's fine. If it's the end, that's where I'm troubled by it. You know, if people stop at the Bohr atom and don't go any farther for the rest of their lives, that's not a good use of an analogy, in my opinion.
Well said. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's a useful tool. You know, you use the ratchet wrench, it doesn't do. You got to use the impact wrench, it doesn't do. You got to use the torch. I just see, I go to mechanical versus the electrical, but I have a piece of both of me in my history. I think we need to all bridge those realms a little bit to spread our understanding of the world.
AC2GS, I agree with you, Jim. It's just one of the saddest things I hear in this hobby is guys who got interested in ham radio, went out, got a tech license, they bought a Balfunk because everyone told everyone else that you got to have a Balfunk. And that's it. All they have is a Balfunk. And after a while with a Balfunk, the valve bung's in their drawer. And that's the end of that. So much for the hobby. So, you know, again, I have nothing wrong with ladders. I use them. Everyone else uses them. Don't let yourself get stuck on one of the rungs. That's all I urge the people out there. Try to climb higher. See how high you can climb.
And encourage those on the ladder with you.
Yep. Onward and upward. I think we kind of smacked this one around about as much as we can smack it. If anyone has any closing comments, please feel free. Okey-doke. Well, I remain AC2GS. This remains the Limark Technical Net. We still have a bit more time, so if people have any questions or comments or topics that they would like to have a chat about, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Headlight to H.
Yes, Lou. Yes, Lou?
Yeah. Big Bang Theory, is that on its way out from James Webb or what?
Well, I happen to have had a similar conversation with someone who checked into the TechNet tonight. I think we're signing its death certificate way too early. There have been sightings of something that may or may not be a galaxy. If they are a galaxy, they look like they don't belong there, because I think redshift and such would suggest that it's only 300 million years after the beginning of the universe. So if it's legitimately a galaxy that looks like somewhat mature, but was, you know, 13.7 billion years ago, then there's something terribly wrong. But that behooves us to make absolutely sure that we're looking at a galaxy. There are guys, when this was presented 6 months ago, who suggested that we might be misinterpreting the images to be a mature galaxy. They might be something completely different. So the short answer is, no, I don't think the Big Bang is quite dead yet. I think there's still a lot of reconnoitering and figuring out what those bodies that are being picked up on James Webb really are. It's sort of like, if you remember a couple of years ago, some guys came up with a measurement that suggested they found a particle that traveled faster than the speed of light, and then about 8-9 months later, they said, never mind, it was a lab error.
Okay. All righty. So the Doppler shift to infrared gives them an idea of distance, right? Because now that includes the expansion of the universe?
Yes, that's part of the relativistic cause of the redshift.
Okay, and even accounting for that, this potential early galaxy would still have only occurred, what is it, a couple of 100 million years after the Big Bang, a little too early for it to be fully developed.
Yeah, according to the articles, the redshift, they think it's suggestive of being about 300 million years after the Big Bang. But you got to keep in mind that this is just a point of light. People are assuming that it is a large, mature galaxy based on the level of light it's putting out. It could be some really interesting esoteric astronomical object that we haven't quite seen before that just produces an image that's suggestive of a mature galaxy, but could be something really strange, you know. Who knows? It could be one of those magnetars, those quasars, something similar to a quasar that's just emitting massive quantities of magnetic energy and interacting with the local plasma or something. Who knows? But I think it's way too early to kind of put the gravestone on the Big Bang. Other people have suggested that they'll just change the timing to make it more than 13.8 billion years, but we have nothing to go on for any other number. The 13.8 is based upon two independent factors, one being the cosmic background and the other being Hubble constant.
Yeah, the background radiation. Okay, so I've once heard that there's really, you know, if the universe is infinite, and I don't know if that's supported by Big Bang or not, maybe that's not because it was condensed at one point, but if it were infinite, there's really no center. Everybody can claim the center. So my question is, does the Webb telescope presumably point in a particular direction as an origin, or does it matter? In other words, can they look in another direction and maybe get some supporting information?
No, I don't know the mechanics of the James Webb telescope. I would assume there's a degree of steerability to it, but I could be completely wrong. Again, it's really interesting that I had this kind of conversation on email today. The way that this, some people like to do, I used earlier today a balloon with a couple of black magic marker marks, and as you blow it up, everything's moving away from everything else. With the exception of we're in a galactic cluster where we're close enough to local other galaxies for our gravitational fields to couple, and we go off sort of in the same direction, or we go off towards each other due to the attraction. But generally speaking, everything's flying away from everything else. So I tend to use the balloon with the magic marker. Other people seem to like raisin bread as it rises. All the little raisins go farther away from each other. So for the most part, I think that's what astronomers have been watching for a long, long time, that everything, as especially farther away than our galactic cluster, is just going away from us in every other direction.
W-S-2-N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, as far as James Webb goes, it's always facing away from the sun because it's 1 million miles away from the Earth. You know, in other words, it's the sun, Earth, James Webb, that's 1 million miles away, and it stays that way as it rotates around the sun. So right now we're heading into winter. It'll be looking at the constellations in our winter view, and as time goes along, it'll be spring and summer, you know, and it'll be always looking away from the sun. You can't point James Webb in the direction of the moon or the Earth. You know, if they're afraid of you would destroy the charge couple devices that are actually in all the photons. So it's always looking away, and then, you know, next year it'll be back where it is now, and then it could be staring in one place for a long period of time, but not indefinitely. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much. Is it slightly steerable? Can you kind of tweak and adjust it if it's not straight on where you want to see, but it's close by?
Yeah, they have momentum wheels. You know, they can spin them up one way or another, and you could have it look up a little bit, down a little bit. You know, you could scoot to the what I would call the left. And then the right, you know. But yeah, everything in that direction. You just can't swing it around and go, you know, pointing toward Earth. If you want to look in the other direction, wait 6 months, and then you can do it. Back to you, Earth.
AC2GS. Very good, Paul. Thank you. Well, like I said before, Lou, basically, if you look at most of the distant stars, they're all going away. With the exception, unfortunately, of Andromeda, which is a nearby galaxy that we're going to collide with in a long, long time where no one we know needs to worry about it. But it's not going to be fun when that happens. Although it's not like the stars will collide with each other. They'll probably just kind of mess up each other's gravitational fields and disrupt all kinds of galactic phenomena.
And Y2H, yeah, well, I don't know what the timeline is. Is that before or after the sun consumes the Earth? Because if it's after, then maybe we'll have a binary star for us, you know, the suns. But I guess my question is this. This potential early galaxy that might throw the whole theory away, is it only in that direction? In other words, 6 months later, when it's pointing in the other direction, is there any useful information that they can get? Or are we to presume that the Big Bang happened in one location, and by location, I mean relative to us today, that's the place to look at, and 6 months from now, when they're looking in the other direction, usable information in that direction to support or refute this theory. You get what I'm saying? Is it really localized to that one direction where all this information is going to come from?
H-O-S-C-P when you're done, Roy.
It's deja vu all over again, ain't it, Chris? Okay. Let me just mention that we're going to collide with an Andromeda in about 4.5 billion years. So I think that's long after the sun burns out the solar system. So that's one thing, unfortunately. The way that if the Big Bang is legitimate, if theory is legitimately correct, then it all started as a point source. So we are all at the center of the inflation. So there's no such thing as the center. Every place is the center. What James Webb is doing is looking down the light cone at the oldest light waves that can reach us, which are the farthest away. So any place that you look, if you focus, if there was stuff at 13.8 billion years ago, you will see the remnants. The idea is to find an area that doesn't have a lot of populated, present or not so present stars, and have a kind of eye line to the 13.8 billion years ago light that finally reached us. So you can, if you're lucky, you can find it almost in any direction. They happen to have found that strange thing in that direction, but it should be 360 degrees. It should be an isotropic distribution if it's legitimate.
Very clear. Thank you. And I guess Chris is going to get it.
Okay, Chris, you kind of predicted the future there.
Boy, I sure did. Where do I start? So let me start here. We were discussing earlier separately about frame of reference, and my question right now to start this is, do you see what direction, it doesn't matter what you call it, east, west, up, down, obviously there is no up, down, or east, west in space. I'm sure they have some designation of a directorial. But do we know what direction we are moving? So what is our galaxy moving as a whole? What direction is that galaxy going? They always depict all these galaxies spreading out and all moving kind of in the same direction, but spreading out. And I think this is kind of what Lou is alluding to. Are there ones in the other direction going the opposite direction? And which way are we going? So the real question first is, do we know what direction we're going? Over to you, Roy.
In order to have a direction, you need to really have a reference point. And as I wrote you, there is no absolute reference point. We don't know what the universe is. Lou alluded to it earlier, and we talked about it on the TechNet more than a few times. Is it an open universe? Is it a closed universe? Is it saddle-shaped? Is it spherical? As far as astronomers are concerned, it is almost completely flat. I think it's off by 0.4 degrees. So that would either mean, but the problem is our measurements, that could be within the range of our measurement errors. So if the universe is perfectly flat, then it goes on. Does it go on infinitely? Well, then you got a problem of what does infinitely mean? The universe could simply stop at the end of space and time, which, as far as I'm concerned, is about as infinite as you can get, but it might be an actual length, but we don't know. We only know what...
I timed out the repeater.
Sometimes he has problems with all stuff.
Okay, let's see if I'm back. Okay, I'm back. That's nice. Let me try again. I don't know when I got cut off, but if you look east, everything is traveling away the east. If you look west, everything's traveling away the west. North, everything's traveling away the north. For all intents and purposes, every cosmic bit and particle from its reference point, everything around it is traveling quickly away from it, except for local gravitationally coupled galaxies. So, you know, the Milky Way is not traveling away from us. We're embedded in it by a gravitational field. And the same thing as far as Andromeda. That's why in 4.5 billion years, we're going to collide with poor Andromeda. So that's one case where Andromeda is not racing away from us. Just because we're gravitationally coupled, you know, we have galactic clusters, and that kind of phenomena counters the general, nature of inflation, if you will.
It's an extremely, extremely difficult subject to understand or to visualize. You can't visualize. That's a problem. I wonder if anyone has ever tried to look at a galaxy very, very far away, one of the farthest galaxies, and then tried to look the other direction and tried to see the same galaxy to prove that it's just a giant loop and we're seeing the same stuff just in different directions. The whole frame of referencing in the universe is just doesn't make any sense. I just can't make any sense of it.
Okay, so you're sort of thinking of it as a sphere, and it might be a sphere, but it's a really, 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 really big sphere. So that galaxy might just be, I don't know, a billion light years going forward. So if you kind of say, well, I think I live in a closed spherical universe, where I should be able to see it going around and coming back on me at 180 degrees at the back of my head. Well, you might be, but it's a trillion billion light years in that direction. So you're not going to really see it well.
Understood, but something like James Webb, and by the way, you, I thought I read that they're seeing an object that's 26 billion light years away as opposed to 13 billion, which is what the old Big Bang theory is. Is that not correct?
There was a couple of reports on the subject. One kind of threw out 26 billion. I don't know what the basis of that, whether that was based upon the redshift of something that they found as well. The initial report was something that was supposedly 300 million years after the Big Bang that looked like something much more mature. But there might have been other things with unexplainable redshifts. Again, is it possible that everyone got everything wrong? Yeah, sure it is. Is it possible that they got the calculation of the redshift wrong, or there's something else going on that someone hasn't figured out quite yet? I think that's more likely given the circumstances, but time hopefully will tell. You know, people will look into it further and further. They'll look farther and farther, and if they see a lot of discrepancies, well, that would be an indication that something serious is going on. If this is the only discrepancy, then it may simply be some measurement error due to who knows what.
Right. And wait till H.
Yes, Lou.
So, would gravitational lensing
have a spectral effect? In other words, can it be like a prism and maybe shift the colors a little bit and screw up the whole infrared distancing algorithm?
I don't see where how it would do that because you know it doesn't shift it to some you know the point is it's practically a point of light. It's not smeared. If it was a big light and gravity kind of dispersed it like a prism and you grabbed the wrong portion, then the trying to read a portion of a star or a galaxy source would probably introduce all kinds of confusion, but I don't see that happening for something that enormously far away, unless you think that it isn't far away, and that's what's simply introducing the strange redshift. And the problem is that there's a lot of gravitational lensing that's already been analyzed that doesn't demonstrate these artifacts. So that's interesting, but I don't quite know how it would shift the spectrum. It would might separate it, and if you didn't recognize what was happening, lead to some confusion. But otherwise, I don't know how it would just shift the entire frequency range with the usual absorption bands and the hydrogen atom range. I don't know.
Yeah, I was thinking akin to a prism-like lens or a chromatic aberration, whatever, but, all right. And as far as the analogy of the balloon with the dots on it, I guess that's a good one because it allows for no center, or everybody is a center. It allows for equal expansion in all directions. And it allows for no edges, whereas if we're on like a pancake and the space-time is expanding, it would imply there's an edge there somewhere, a boundary. So, just some thoughts.
Yeah, personally, I like the balloon analogy better than the raisin cake. A lot of people tend to prefer the raisin cake. I don't know. The only problem that I get with that is that you're describing a three-dimensional, really a four-dimensional, but we'll forget about time, a three-dimensional concept on a two-dimensional surface, you know, the sphere of a pseudosphere of a balloon. But, yeah, I think that that's a decent analogy. You know, not perfect. Again, there's no perfect analogies that I'm aware of.
Here. H-O-S-T-P, Roy, for a follow-up.
Certainly, Chris.
Okay, so what do you use, or what do they use, I should say, the scientists, to come up with the value of the distance of the so-called Big Bang? So it's 13 point whatever billion light years away. Is that a... I believe it's like radiation or something. That's where radiation stops. So what exactly are we looking at to come up with that number for the big distance of the Big Bang?
Okay. There are sort of two bases for the age of the Big Bang. One is the cosmic background microwave, that at the very instant that the universe came into existence as we know it, that it was full of intensely high-energy photons. And as inflation expanded the universe, the total, the intense energy got spread thinner and thinner, and the frequency dropped lower and lower, again, due to Doppler shifting and such. And so now what was once near absolute energy is down to microwaves. So they have equations where they suggest how long it might take for a cosmic microwave background energy to kind of coalesce at the center at a incredibly high energy, and that gives them approximately 13.78, I believe. The other is, I'm blanking on. There's a constant for the acceleration of the universe, and up until recently they thought it was a constant, but it seems to be accelerating. And so what they do is they take the velocity and the rate of acceleration, and they go back in time until everything is in a single spot. And the numbers they come up with are, again, something like 13.78 billion years.
Okay. Not sure what that does for me, but understood. I've always wondered where they came up with those numbers, but thank you, Roy. And, by the way, your knowledge of these things boggles my mind pretty much as the universe does, K2SDP.
Well, I try my best. I joke that I might have been a librarian in a previous life, and whenever I wonder about something, I look it up. I've mentioned repeatedly one of the great puzzles of electronics that I shared with Dick May, rest in peace, was that if you look at Maxwell's equations, when you induce magnetic and electric fields, they're pretty much always 90 degrees out of phase with each other. So, but electromagnetic fields in the far field are in phase. So somehow in the near phase, they're 90 degrees out of phase. In the far field, they're 0 degrees out of phase. And I have yet to get a good answer of why that's the fact, to the point where I actually purchased the guy's PhD thesis on the subject. And I'm still not quite sure why that happens. But, yeah, I'm curious. That's basically, and we live that, thankfully, in a modern age where I don't have to rely on encyclopedias, which I used when I was a little kid. I have Google, and I have all kinds of other source material at my fingertips. So, and I'm glad to share it, and I'm glad to talk about it. This stuff really interests me. Me and Dick used to chat about these things all the time during the science talk, and I kind of miss it a little bit. So I thank you and Lou of bringing back a portion of it.
Well, thank you, Roy, for sharing your knowledge with us. Pretty incredible. And just for the record, I think you know this already. I personally don't believe we have any idea what the Big Bang is, how far it was, or what the universe is, or how big it is. I think the next instrument we make will see something double as far as what we're seeing now. James Webb, if I'm right, doubled the distance already to 26 million billion years, light years away. And I just think there's so many unknowns. I think it's ridiculous for us to even guess at what we're looking at. I don't think we have any idea. As crazy and smart as we have scientists like yourself, I just think there's too much unknown, and I just can't see us actually knowing what we think we know.
Okay, I understand that, and that's fine. Doubt is fine. Skepticism is fine. I don't think that should be the reason to not search out for answers. You may get the wrong answers, but if you keep looking, you may get better answers, and over time, very good answers. And that's sort of the history of science. If you basically decide that this is all too much for us and sit on a rock, then as our ancestors once did, then we'd still be sitting on rocks and we wouldn't be talking tonight. I kind of take the skepticism and the idea that reality is more weird than we could possibly dream onto a different level, where I think it's legitimate possibility that just because we live in this universe doesn't mean that this is the only universe. It's within possibilities that our universe is simply one of many embedded in a hyperdimensional environment that we have no clue about because we're stuck on this brain. But someday we might know a little bit better, most likely we won't know the complete, solution to everything, because it's probably a lot more complicated than our brains are.
Hey, Roy, and I also believe that as well. There's multiple universes. That's my theory, anyway. And I really would like somebody to try my experiment that I repeated earlier. Try to find the galaxy in one direction and then find it in the other direction. Because I have a funny feeling we're in a giant loop or sphere. 2SCP. Thank you.
Welcome, Chris. I appreciate you bringing up the subject, and I'm very thankful that Lou brought it up today simultaneously. And again, the problem is, in the same way that Fermi's problem, if there are almost an infinite number of stars out there, why is the sky so dark? Because a lot of them are very, very far away, and the inverse square law. So although it is possible that everything kind of whips around, we don't know how big the universe is. We know how big, or we think we know how big the observable universe is, but that's probably a small percentage. A lot of people tend to think that for sundry reasons that the total universe is something like 240 times the volume of the observable universe, but there's nothing definitively saying that it isn't, a Googleplex times larger. So it just has a much longer distance circling back on itself. So with that considered, you might be seeing the same galaxy from behind your head, except that the light had to take so long to travel that it's the light that was there, 30 billion years ago, which is nothing. So there's also that aspect of it.
We got that entire transmission, Roy. And that's another part of it that I often think about is this stuff is 13 billion years old light. We have no idea if it exists any longer. In fact, it probably doesn't exist. So what we're looking at doesn't even exist anyway in the first place. So we don't even know if any of this stuff's still there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would be willing to bet that it isn't there, or it's changed so much that it's going to be unrecognizable. What you're looking at is more historical than it is our present reality. It's what, it's like an archaeological dig, only in space.
More stuff to just boggle the mind. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I've often said that science is like an onion. You think you got it figured out, and then you peel away that layer, and geez, there's lots of trouble underneath. If you figure that one out, there's always going to be another layer. That's why I doubt that humanity will live long enough to be all-knowing. It would be interesting to know a lot of things, but, I still think we're very fortunate to live in a particular time in this world where technology has advanced, scientific research has advanced. Every day, if you sleep late, you're going to miss some breakthrough in some form of technology. I recently mentioned to someone that I bought a little wallwart power supply that needed to supply 30 watts, which is kind of a lot for a small power plug. I got something that's the size of an Apple wallwart that used to feed about 5 watts. But they use new technology. They use gallium nitride field effects transistors, which allow for a lot more efficient, higher power use in smaller power supplies. And so, that's another great thing that was invented relatively recently that's coming to the market. So, there's always new stuff. You can't sleep. Okay, we have a little bit of silence, and I'll give anyone a chance. If not, then we'll just move on to the SpaceNet report, because it's coming up to 10:15. We've got 4 minutes, but if someone has something quick that they want to say or talk about, then please hit that push to talk.
AC to GS. K82OTB, Mobile.
Hello, Craig. I hope you are well. Long time no speak.
I'm doing well. Just left Dave and Buster's, and I am back from Florida and Virginia. Had a lot of fun. A little while ago, I had a very interesting topic with a couple of people.